Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, more than 5.8 million Americans are living with Alzheimer's disease, and more than 16 million Americans have found themselves in the role of caregiver, unpaid caregivers. This hour, we'll talk about the challenges, lessons learned, and the importance of self-care, also the joy and beauty that can be found and shared in spite of this cruel disease. Alzheimer's disease is an irreversible progressive brain disorder that slowly destroys memory and thinking skills. It is the most common cause of dementia in older adults and the 6th leading cause of death in the United States. We are focusing this hour on the experience of caregivers. And to start us off, Dr. Yogesh Shah is here of the Geriatric Medicine and Memory Center at Broadlawns Medical Center in Des Moines. Hello, Dr. Shah.
Hello, Charity. Good morning.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And the statistics on Alzheimer's disease are devastating and scary. I mentioned 5.8 million Americans are living with Alzheimer's. By 2050, that number is projected to rise to nearly 14 million. So we're seeing an incredible rise in the number of people being diagnosed with Alzheimer's. What do we know about that?
First of all, Charity, let me thank you for picking this topic. It's so important that we talk about caregivers. So thank you, and thank you to Alzheimer's Association and Iowa Chapter for doing what they do for caregivers. So we know many things now. We know that dementia is not a normal part of aging. Yes, we see people who are, as we get older and elder, we get more chance of memory loss, but that doesn't make it normal. Second big thing we know, and which I like us to talk a little bit about, is that if pick up early, if we can catch dementia in a pre-dementia state, the state we call it as a mild cognitive impairment or MCI, then one third of all dementias can be prevented by picking it in an early stage and by doing few things like taking care of our chronic conditions, whether it's a hearing loss, depression, hypertension, diabetes, managing our numbers better, taking care of our lifestyle, eating well, exercise, social connection. And then third thing is taking care of medicines, what we take, both over-the-counter or prescription drugs. Because many drugs we doctors give are potentially can affect our memory. So looking into those. So we do know a lot. We know a lot of causes of why it happens, the abnormal collection of protein in our brain. We know many different types of dementias. As you mentioned, Alzheimer's is the most common. There are many other types. One is called Lewy body dementia. Another is called frontotemporal. There is a vascular. So we know a lot now. We have ways to detect early. It's called biomarkers. Like in diabetes, we have blood wave. We can check people's hemoglobin A1C or blood sugar, and we know a person might or might not have diabetes.
Well, and you mentioned all of the different kinds of dementia. Of course, I think a lot of us maybe group all of those kinds of dementia into the idea that it's Alzheimer's disease. But you can't actually definitively diagnose Alzheimer's disease until someone has passed away, right?
It used to be, Charity, that thought many, many years ago. Now we clinicians are almost 97-99% certain of what type of dementia a patient might have. Through our clinical exam histories, through the neuroimaging, meaning the MRI or the CAT scan, we can do. There are PET scans, special type of scans, which can pick up also what type of dementia. And the reason for it's us, both clinicians and caregivers, to know what type, that each type has its own prognosis. And one dementia might progress very fast. For example, Lewy body might progress faster than Alzheimer's. So knowing the type, knowing the staging of disease does become important for caregivers, for patients, but more for caregivers of what to expect.
Let's talk about those conversations with caregivers, because, of course, this can be a devastating diagnosis for the patient, for someone who's experiencing this. But it affects their loved ones in a great measure, almost equally to the person who's experiencing the disease themselves. As a doctor, how do you start those conversations with the people who love your patient?
For me, Charity, for every patient, when they come, they have to come with their caregiver or their power of attorney or family member. And the conversation starts with both. In the early stages of the disease, patients are my patients, meaning they're the one who has the problem and we discuss. As the disease progresses, so there are three stages of dementia in general, early or mild, moderate or middle, and late. When the disease becomes moderate or late, the patients probably don't realize much what's going on around them. And it's most of the time the caregiver becomes indirectly my patients. I tend to spend more time with them about how they are feeling, how much rest they are getting, how much time they're spending for their own care, and tell them and try to give them the tools they might need to become strong and better caregiver.
How do you help someone? Because, of course, everybody is in a different life situation, but most of the people who will become caregivers of patients with Alzheimer's, they may not have experience as a caregiver. And the kinds of care that you need to give someone with memory loss are unique. So where do you start?
We like for any chronic conditions, we need three things. We need proper education about the disease. So for here, caregivers need to know what dementia means, what are the different types, what type does my loved one have, and what stage is my loved one in that dementia process. So that's one. And then along with that would come all the thing about education, support groups, connecting with Alzheimer's Association, connecting with a group called Aging Resources here, finding the right people who can then create a network where if I need some time off, then I'll can call this group of people or this person. So that's one, education about the condition. Second, the caring for myself. And self-care is not selfish. I need that 15, 20 minutes per day for myself, just to take care of myself so I become better caregiver rest of the day.
And it sounds like that's something that you feel like a lot of caregivers maybe don't give themselves permission for.
No, they don't. They don't. They feel kind of guilty every time they take 10 minutes walk outside. They feel guilty when they get massage for relaxation for 1 hour. Every time they go away from the patient, from my patient, their loved one, they feel that they are not spending time with them, which in a way becomes vicious circle. They get stressed out. There is a kind of potential for anger. There's potential for physical or abuse. But if they tend to spend time on their own, this very likely they'll become better caregiver. And the third thing, it depends on person, but then is acceptance of the disease. Unlike many, many conditions in our life, dementia, as you mentioned, most of the dementia, not all, but most of the dementias are non-reversible. So they need to accept that, yes, where we are and what's the unaccepted part of the disease.
You mentioned the support groups. And I can imagine that that's extremely important to many caregivers because dementia is going to be different. Alzheimer's is going to be different for every patient. And I've heard, you know, stories where the patient in some ways becomes easier to be around and finds a lot of joy and a lot of laughter. But I've also heard stories about the opposite, where someone who was a joyful person or a kind person loses that part of themselves to the disease as well. With these support groups, I can imagine that it's important to talk to other people who maybe have had similar experiences.
Yes, and luckily in Iowa, through Alzheimer's Association, we have many different support groups for different stage of the disease. So for early stages, there might be one support group where the behavior problems, what you touched on, might not be an issue. It might be just the issue of how to keep the person active. when the disease progresses, about 80 to 90% of patients tend to have some form of personality change or some form of behavior change, which is not caregivers are used to. And that's what most of the time, Charity, it's not memory which bothers the caregiver. It's their changed loved one, changed personality, change of behavior. Now they are more aggressive. They might see things which are not in the room. They become paranoid. They tend to feel that somebody's in the house who should not be. Somebody's stealing from my bedroom who should not be. Or the spouse might have an affair, they feel paranoia. So those are the things which, of course, bothers the caregiver. So the support group, the way it helps, when they go to support group, and if they share this, then somebody, five other caregivers might say, oh, yeah, this happened with us. That's normal. That's part of the disease. And it will get better with this thing or that thing or this medication. So I feel, along with knowing the proper diagnosis, having right amount of number of support group, formal or informal support group, is very helpful.
A lot of us also want to be able to keep our loved one in our home. But with Alzheimer's, that is not always possible because there are so many dangers. What do you say to the caregivers of your patients about when it's time to decide to find a home?
I strongly, in our clinic at Broadlands, we strongly support the concept of staying in their own home as long as possible with all the supports we can give. Luckily, there are many, many different types of home agencies. They are focused on patients with dementia. So getting them sooner than what the caregivers might feel. Most caregivers feel that they will be able to take care of the patient with dementia till the end, which is good thinking, but most time it doesn't happen because there's a lot of need. So giving them the information of Alzheimer's Association, giving them the information about aging resources, giving them the right contact about different forms of home care agencies, and then if needed, then they can still have physical therapy, speech therapy, occupational therapy to go to their home to see how long they can live in their own home environment.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me, Dr. Yogesh Shah of the Geriatric Medicine and Memory Center at Broadlands Medical Center in Des Moines. This hour, we're talking about caregivers for Alzheimer's patients. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the challenges and, yes, also the joys of caring for a loved one with Alzheimer's. Dr. Yogesh Shah of Geriatric Medicine and Memory Center at Broadlands Medical Center in Des Moines is with us. And now I want to bring someone into the conversation who has personal experience as a caregiver. Edith Crawford is a community educator and a member of the Alzheimer's Association Iowa Chapter Board of Directors. She was also her mother's primary caregiver. Hello, Edith.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here. And tell me a little bit about your mother.
Wow. My mother was a single parent, and she had 9 children. And she was a very strong, feisty lady. She was very strong.
How old was she when she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's?
Probably in her latter 40s, early 50s.
Oh, how heartbreaking.
About around that time, latter 40s or early 50s.
So she had Alzheimer's that was a youthful onset. That's an early time to get Alzheimer's. When she was diagnosed, did that come as a shock to you?
We had had a couple of episodes. We called them things that caught our attention. She was very meticulous about pretty much everything. And when we noticed that she wasn't as tuned in to some of the things that she always did, that kind of piqued our interest, but it didn't really settle with us. And then when we had an episode, she traveled alone to Missouri one year to see her sister. And when she returned, she didn't know who she was or where she was going. And that was the eye-opener. That was the main catalyst that started us to really looking at what was going on with her.
Being from a large family, having eight brothers and sisters, when it was time to figure out how to take care of your mom, how did you and your siblings make those decisions?
It was very hard. My mother was diagnosed in a time where there wasn't facilities or there wasn't any information out there on what to do, where to go. And so it really was left upon us to figure it out. And it was very trying for our family. It surely didn't break us up, but it sure caused a lot of just a lot of grief, added grief through what we were going through, mainly because of the denial aspect of the disease. There is a denial that is set in to some that it's harder to embrace what they're seeing. Mm-hmm. So it was very devastating to our family, but we had to come to a conclusion that it was not about us, that it was about our mom. And so we collectively pulled it together and was able to handle her affairs. We divided up her duties and just handled her affairs as she would handle them. And that brought us closer together in terms of the understanding of what was going on and the diminishing of this our stable person in our life.
How long did she live with Alzheimer's?
I would say she, actually a very long time. I would say about 15, pretty close to 20 years. When she actually was diagnosed, I guess I would take away 5 years of us not knowing. So probably, if I added it all up, I'd say close to 20 years.
Wow. You mentioned that when your mother was diagnosed that memory care facilities were not easy to come by. So did you care for her in your home throughout this whole period?
We did, up until the very end. We kept her at home. She was living in Colorado with myself and my three sisters. We alternated her from home to home, which was not a good thing to do, but we were working and we had nowhere to for care for her. Periodically, we would bring her back to Des Moines to our brothers, and they would care. They and their wives would care for her for a period of time, just to actually get them acclimated as well to what was going on with her. Eventually, we had to place her in a facility. Very hard, very guilt-ridden. But she was a walker, and she was, the disease made her combative, and a lot of things were going on that a lot of people don't understand. And so we were really guilt-ridden when we had to. We did find a facility in her community, senior citizens community, where she lived. So we kept her home 90% of the time.
You talk about the guilt that you dealt with, and that's something that so many caregivers do deal with if they feel like they can't give the care that they want to be able to give, and mm-hmm. the challenges that you were facing with trying to live your life and have a family mm-hmm. and have a job and do all the things. What do you wish you had known then? You do so much education now. What do you wish someone had told you when you were going on this journey?
Oh, there's a lot. I wish that there was more knowledge of what was going on, open-minded knowledge. A lot of the other diseases got a lot of attention, but Alzheimer's didn't quite get the attention and still doesn't get the attention that cancer or some of the others had. I wish that the facilities were more equipped. The nurses and the doctors were more educated on how to handle people with dementias at that time. I wish that caregivers would realize that they can't do it alone, that they have to seek out some help, especially those that are doing it alone or just one or two in the family. So I wish that there was more education for all of those things that would help the caregiver today.
I was looking at some statistics today, and it's hard to put a number on this, but one of the articles that I read that was published back in 2009 said that the prevalence of cognitive impairment or Alzheimer's disease might be 2 or 3 times higher among older African Americans than among members of other groups. Given what you're saying about lack of knowledge and just those incredible numbers, this incredible challenge for Black Americans, what do you think we need to know? What do we need to tell people about the risks, about the prevalence of Alzheimer's?
During my presentations, prior to that fact, we get facts every year, printed facts with the association. Prior to knowing that African Americans got it twice as more likely, my presentation was just straightforward from what the National sent to us to present to the public. But as I was telling one of my directors the other day, I've modified my presentations. One, because I'm targeting the African American churches, and that's through an initiative, Memory Sunday. We kicked off on June 9th, we kicked off Memory Sunday, where we were talking to the African American churches about that fact, that we get it twice as more likely. And the association has just started a program called Faith Outreach, where we've divided up all the churches in the city, and the volunteers that are willing to do this portion of it are going into the churches. I personally have targeted the African American churches, so I'm going around the city speaking to any church that will open the door and let me in. So that's what I do when I do my presentation. I've kind of tweaked it to the audience, the specific audience that I have, and I give more of the African American statistics in the churches than I do. You know, I do touch on the stats, but I hammer it in when I go to the churches, because there's something that's very well need to be known.
Right. And I can imagine you think about how things might have been different, or at least a little bit easier, if your family had known those facts, to see the early signs with your mother.
Absolutely, absolutely. I play it back. You know, I go backwards a lot in my thinking in terms of, well, if we had known this, at the time it wasn't called, well, it was called Alzheimer's because that, they named it Alzheimer's in 1980, but most definitely they were calling it senility and hardening of the arteries. The word Alzheimer's didn't come into to vocal play for a number of years after it was named that. So a lot of that was going on was the stigma of hardening of the arteries, and just anything to do with the brain was a no-no.
Mm-hmm.
It just was a lack of knowledge. And so with the knowledge we have now, I feel very empowered in terms of speaking to the audiences, well, the people that I'm speaking to, because I see the spark in the eye of the person sitting there. I see so many faces that, like, I'm taking care of someone, and, oh, my God, somebody knows what I'm talking about, or somebody just said what I was telling someone else, and they didn't understand it. So, that's what I think about it.
Edith Crawford of Des Moines, she cared for her mother with Alzheimer's disease. And with me now, Dr. Yogesh Shah of the Geriatric Medicine and Memory Center at Broadlands Medical Center in Des Moines. Dr. Shah, Edith's story brings up so many questions. Her mother was so young when she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. The early onset Alzheimer's is such an incredible tragedy. But what do people need to know about it so they can recognize the signs?
So, Charity, what Edith mentioned, it's a very important topic about dementia being twice more common in African-American patient population than rest. And there are multiple reasons for that. One of the reasons is that African-American tends to have more vascular conditions like hypertension, diabetes, stroke, and obesity. Second, there is a more social determinants of health issues with African-American patient population than others, meaning they don't have access to transportation to go to clinics as frequently. And third, by disease itself, pathology is different in African-American patients. So with all those three conditions, it's twice more common. And luckily, we have very nice support from churches in Des Moines area, especially the one which is Corinthian Baptist Church. The pastor there is Jonathan Whitfield, and he has been very supportive of educating his members about the disease which can happen. And if caught early, as I mentioned, we can prevent one-third of dementias.
The signs that people see with early onset dementia, I can imagine that those are really easy to overlook. I mean, you were talking earlier about how important it is to catch any kind of dementia in early stages. So what is your advice for people if they start to see lapses of memory or if they experience them themselves?
So yeah, there's something called just normal aging. We all forget name of people whom we don't come across frequently.
Yes,
that's normal.
I'm 44 years old and I experienced that.
And me too.
Already.
I have the same issue. But if we forget name of the close loved one, the family members, the neighbors whom we are supposed to be meeting frequently, then I would worry. Most of us forget where we parked our car in a big parking lot at Jordan Creek Mall or maybe in Iowa City during the game. But if I forget when I come out of the parking lot or the Costco or the Walmart and forget that I brought my car here and rather call Uber, then that's not normal. So we know what's normal aging and what's memory lost during normal aging. We know what's not normal. So in nutshell, Charity, what happens is it's a cognitive decline. It's not just memory loss. It's a cognitive decline enough that we lose our independence in some capacity, meaning now because I'm getting lost many times, I can't drive properly. I can't do my finances properly because I'm writing my checks once, twice on the same company. I can't cook on my own because I forget that I left my food on the stove and it catches fire. So it's not just forgetting recipe once in a while since I've not cooked since last Thanksgiving, but it's day-to-day life. I can't do anymore, and loses my independence. So there's a connection between. So those are the two terms, that it's a enough cognitive decline, which is affecting my independence. While in case of pre-dementia or mild cognitive impairment, there is not sufficient decline to affect my independence. Yeah, I forget my taxes might take longer than 3 days to collect all the papers, but ultimately I can still do it. I might not forget the exit street, but I ultimately reach my destination. In case of dementia, they might leave town and go to Kansas and then forget where they are even going.
Dr. Shaw, stay with us. I want to bring another caregiver into the conversation. Ken Gregerson is primary caregiver to his wife, Evie, who currently lives in a care facility in Ankeny. They're both in their 80s. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Charity. Thank you for having us on.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And Ken, we're just going to talk for about a minute. We're going to take a short break and then be back. But I do want you to start. Can you tell me just a little bit about Evie?
Yes, I sure can. Evie is my wife of 66 years. She probably has had dementia or Alzheimer's for more than 10 years, although her official diagnosis was in 2012. But I noticed some early symptoms where she didn't want to use the telephone. She used to love to play bridge, and she almost quit playing games, and she became rather quiet. If it hadn't been for our family doctor asking questions of her, and she would always defer to me, that the family doctor said, I think we need to have you see someone. So that's what started us on the journey. I find that being a caregiver goes through stages just much like the illness itself. At first, I considered it kind of a nuisance because, sure, I had to answer the same question over and over again. I had to help her find her purse many times during the day. I always made sure there was some money in her purse, and yet she insisted that she never had any money. She wanted to know who those strangers were in the house, and if I did leave her for any length of time, she might, if she came looking for me, she might wander off and the neighbors would bring her back home.
And we'll talk about some of the other stages of caregiving for you in just a moment. We are going to take a short break. We'll be back. Ken Gregerson is with me. We're talking about him being the primary caregiver to his wife, Evie. We also have Dr. Yogesh Shah of the Geriatric Medicine and Memory Center at Broadlawns Medical Center in Des Moines with us. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events, including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about being a caregiver for someone with Alzheimer's. More than 16 million Americans have found themselves in the role of caregiver for someone that they love who has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And this hour, we're talking about the challenges, the lessons learned, the importance of self-care, and also how to find joy and beauty in the midst of this cruel disease. With me right now, Dr. Yogesh Shah of the Geriatric Medicine and Memory Center at Broadlawns Medical Center in Des Moines, and Ken Gregerson, who is primary caregiver to his wife, Evie. He mentioned just a moment ago that they've been married for 66 years. Evie currently lives in a care facility in Ankeny, and Ken has been involved in her care for about a decade. Ken, you were talking before the break about the different stages of caregiving, and you were talking about those early times where there were sort of these constant tasks that needed your attention, finding Evie's purse, dealing with some of her worries, a little bit of paranoia that came along with the disease for her. How did things progress for you?
Well, from it goes as the disease progresses, it causes the way you take care of someone. And There was a time when Evie didn't want me out of her sight. It was even hard for me to go to the bathroom without her wanting to be right there because she was so dependent on me. And then it became a physical thing. When she started falling down and she was no longer ambulatory and bathing and toileting and eating were all things that she could no longer do, that's when I found that I had to start picking her up and physically moving her myself. And I guess I'm not as strong as I used to be, and we started to fall down. We started to have some physical things.
Oh, that must have been so scary.
Nurses came and told me that I either need to have full-time help in the home or find a place for her to live. So I did the latter. I found a home that was near where I live, so I could see her quite often. I'm there 3 times a day to give her meals, and we're still very, very close. We touch, I kiss her, and I talk to her as much as I possibly can. I sing to her every night, and so that's the way I can now take. Still be her caregiver, even though I'm hiring someone to do the hard work and the heavy lifting for her.
Yeah, and you're doing the really important emotional work as well for both of you. There came a point where Evie was no longer able to recognize you, and I know that was one of the biggest challenges you've had to deal with. Tell me a little bit about that.
I think that one of the best examples is also how I happened to get in touch with the Alzheimer's Association. My wife, Evie, didn't know me, and she insisted that I should find her husband. And there's a caregiver's commandments, and I was breaking all those commandments. You know, I was I was arguing with her and saying, no, I am your husband. Or I was trying to tell her that, no, this is your house. Well, that's one of the things that I've learned is that you try to redirect or try to change the subject or try to let them tell you what's going on rather than try to argue with them. But anyway, I was beside myself. I called. I had the 800 number that's on the back of every Alzheimer's brochure. And I called that number at 11:30 at night, and I talked to a counselor. The counselor suggested that I tell her that you were talking to her husband right this moment and that he's going to see you at church in the morning. So I told her that, and we were able to go to bed, and the next morning went to church, and she had completely forgotten about it by that time. So it solved a crisis for me. Well, then when I found this wonderful home for her to be in, it freed me up so that I could do a few things. And so I've gotten involved with two different support groups. And as Dr. Shaw said, support groups can be so important. Most of us, when we're faced with this illness, we think we're all alone. We're the only ones that are going through this experience. And coming to a support group and telling your story to the other people that are there often, and when those people can say, yes, that's happened to me too. I know exactly, or they'll say, I know exactly what you're talking about. It doesn't cure the disease, but it sure does help the morale of those of us who are caregivers.
Absolutely.
I like to think that as a facilitator for a support group, I'm able to describe the mistakes I made so that they won't make the same ones.
Or at least they'll know that they're not alone in making those mistakes. Ken, stay with us. Ken Gregerson is primary caregiver to his wife, Evie, who currently lives in a care facility in Ankeny. And I want to bring another caregiver into the conversation. This is a name familiar to many Iowans. Becky Orr Montgomery, daughter of the legendary Iowa State University basketball coach Johnny Orr and his wife, Rami. She was a caregiver to her mother who died of Alzheimer's. She also owns Senior Home Finder of Iowa and facilitates a support group and volunteers. Hello, Becky.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today. And I can imagine listening to some of the things that Ken is talking about probably sparks a lot of your memories. You were a caregiver for 15 years, right?
Well, I assisted my father in caregiving for the 12 and a half and then 2.5 without him. But yes, absolutely. And it wasn't just me, but I had three sisters and we all worked together to help Dad take care of Mom.
Give me some of what you wish you had known at the beginning of your journey. Of course, your dad was in a similar position to Ken, but you and your sisters were faced with some real challenges too. What do you wish you'd known?
You know what? We don't look back with any regrets whatsoever. We really focused on learning as much as we could when we got the diagnosis. And the most important message we learned was from a book by Jolene Bracke, Creating Moments of Joy. The sooner you recognize they are not in today, the easier it will be for you to keep them happy. They're never coming back. They're not in today and they're never coming back. So we adopted that very early, and we even got my mother to read it. Dad wasn't so big on reading that, but he understood, and he admit he no longer argued with her, which was good. He liked to kind of get her goat once in a while, but as soon as she got diagnosed, he backed off quickly.
So Ken was just talking about some of the mistakes that people make where, you know, the reality that a person with Alzheimer's is living in has shifted radically from the reality that the rest of us are part of. Can you tell me what you learned about embracing your mother's reality?
Well, first we had trouble getting Dad to kind of help us get her diagnosed. Because we knew something was wrong. We communicated about it regularly. Have you talked to Mom? And anyway, so Dad, why don't you pretend, maybe it's her hearing. Why don't you go with her and pretend you need to get your hearing tested? And of course, my father's response was, there's nothing wrong with my hearing. I hear fine out of this ear. You know, he wouldn't play along with that. So his stubbornness, but we eventually got it done. And once we got the diagnosis, we all were on board, thanks to a great social worker who explained the difference between a challenge and a disaster is based entirely on how well you've planned. And that is what the impetus was for us to get on board and figure out how to help them.
I want to talk to you and Ken about finding moments of joy, because this disease is so cruel and caretaking is such difficult work. Becky, finding moments of joy was a really important part of how you helped to care for your mom. Tell me more.
Okay. Well, initially, you know, I would go see her at lunch because Dad was still employed, not by Iowa State, but by Iowa Network Services. So we didn't want her home alone too long. So instead of going to lunch, I'd go hang out with her at lunch. She would look at me and say, "I love your jacket." And I'd say, "Thank you." 2 seconds later, "I love your jacket." And I had developed the concept that it was my job to give her a different answer every time. And I taught my kids to do that. So the second time she says it, I said, "And do you know why?" She said, "Why?" "Because it fits me so well." Again, when it comes back, "I love your jacket." I'd go, "And do you know what's really cool about it?" "What?" "The inside is green." I mean, it's up to you. And you can't just give them the same answer over and over. It's really hard, but the creativity is on you. And I challenged my kids to do that so that if I get it, they treat me well.
So you felt like if you could turn this into a game, then that would also be fun for her because you're in a different frame of mind?
Exactly. And we kind of made sure we were often laughing. I mean, across the board. I have many stories of that. The one time I goofed, I had taken my kids over there because, again, Dad was gone. And we had dinner, and I was a little disappointed in my children and how they were behaving at the table. So after we finished eating, I went outside for a minute when they all had ice cream. I came back in, and I cleared the table, and Mom turned around and said, "Does anybody want ice cream?" And it's the one time I corrected her. And I said, "You know, Mom, they're going to be really mad I'm here. But you just had it, and they don't get it again." But typically, I would have played along and let them have it a second time. But, you know.
I understand. Ken, I want to bring you into the conversation here because you have found that music is a really important way that you can connect with Evie, that other caregivers can connect with those that they love. Tell me about that.
Well, I do love music, and I love to sing. I don't consider myself a singer. I just consider myself someone who likes to sing. And I sing to her every night. And I've also started a hymn singing group at the location where she is. And we also have as part of our care, our support groups, we started a social group called Joy in the Morning. And we have anywhere from 20 to 50 people coming to that. And so that's been, I think, a big reward for me. It's a way I can give back.
So that can be a real social outing. I mean, we've talked about going to the doctors and we've talked about support groups and all of that, but that's a social outing for the caregiver and for the person who is suffering from the disease.
Absolutely. I when I had Evie at home, I looked for places that I could take her with me. And we went to concerts, we went to ball games. We did all kinds of things like that. And one reason we started Joy in the Morning is so that the caregiver could bring their loved one to something where they can just have a good time for a couple of hours. We have some refreshments, we have a little conversation, and then we start singing hymns and secular songs both. And to me, that's very important because the caregiver can't be a good caregiver unless they take care of themselves, unless they find a way to relax themselves. Taking care of a loved one is a 24/7 job, and you kind of sleep with one eye open. And so anytime you can give yourself a break or anytime you can find some joy in going someplace together, you need to do that.
I've also read quite a bit and talked to music therapists about how powerful music can be for someone with Alzheimer's, how it seems to tap into a different kind of memory. Some people can remember song lyrics even if they can't remember anything about their lives. Have you been able to observe how music can really bring somebody back to themselves for a few minutes, Ken?
I sure can. There's so many occasions when we start singing a song that's maybe they learned in Sunday school, like Jesus Loves Me, or maybe it's Old MacDonald Had a Farm, or I've Been Working on the Railroad, and their faces brighten up and they start, if they can't sing it, they'll lip sync it with me. And it's so much fun to stand up in front of this group and see that happen.
That is really lovely. And Dr. Shah, before we run out of time, I'm listening to both Becky and Ken talk about some really beautiful ways that they've been able to find joy. I know I've heard people say, you know, it's hard to visit with my loved one. I know that they forget that I've been there the moment that I leave. What do we need to know about those visits and their importance, even if it's immediately forgotten?
So going going back to what we started, accepting the disease now, that if it's already in the last stages or advanced stage of the dementia, and then with that would come education that, okay, now, as Ken rightly said, that knowing that, yeah, she might not remember my name or my face, but my voice, my songs of the person Abby would remember. And that's very important. For them also, the patients might not recognize the things what he or she used to, but some of the things are still there. Voice might be there, the features might be there, the touch might be there. So what Ken just mentioned is true and very touching, and I hope more caregivers will do similar things.
And even if you have those few minutes together and they're forgotten, do you feel like it makes a difference?
Yeah, if it's forgotten, but it's useful for both. Ken feels that I did my thing, what I'm supposed to do as a husband for 66 years. And for her, she subconsciously feels that. So I feel that's great that he can do it. And hopefully many other caregivers do the same thing.
All right. We have about 30 seconds left. And Ken, I'm going to let you have the final word for someone, whether it's a spouse or a child, someone, a loved one who has a person who has received this diagnosis of Alzheimer's. What is your biggest piece of advice? Where should they start?
Boy, I think they need to get involved with a support group and find someone that can help them over this emotional roller coaster. As a caregiver, you're going to feel all the emotions. You're going to be angry. You're going to feel sad. You're going to feel guilty because maybe I'm not doing the best job that I possibly can. And you're going to have all of those emotions. And if you can share that with other people, it is so helpful. I would certainly recommend that they avail themselves of whatever support groups they can find in their area.
All right. Well, Ken Gregerson, thank you so much. Becky Orr Montgomery, thank you also for being here today.
You bet. Thanks, Charity.
And also a big thank you, Dr. Yogesh Shah.
Charity, thank you. Thank you again for bringing this topic to your viewers and listeners.
Well, thank you, Dr. Shah. And I also want to mention that the Alzheimer's Association hotline is available 24 hours, 800-272-3900. This is Talk of Iowa.